Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of why Donald Trump could become the next president of the United States, given that Trump is a successful salesman who has caught the political world by storm, skillfully selling a product which happens to be himself. Alan Abramowitz, a professor of political science at Emory University and author of Voices of the People, Elections and Voting Behavior in the United States, joins us to discuss if this election will be decided by whether there is a majority of Americans who are no longer active citizens but have become passive consumers, so much so that in November, a well-marketed product will beat a well-established politician. In short, have decades of relentless capitalism made us more experienced as consumers of products and advertising than students of history and facts as informed citizens in a democracy? Then we'll look into the $38 billion 10-year arms deal with Israel announced today that will provide the latest U.S. military technology, which President Obama said, quote, will ensure that Israel has the ability to defend itself from all manner of threats. Kate Gould, the legislative representative for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C., joins us. She lobbies for Israeli-Palestinian peace, and we will discuss this increase in the annual taxpayer subsidy for Israel and its arms industry, which makes Israel the largest recipient of U.S. aid, even though it has a remarkably robust and wealthy economy. Then finally, the Reverend Billy joins us to discuss the merger announced today with the German pharmaceutical, chemical, and pesticide giant Bayer buying Monsanto in a $66 billion all-cash takeover, the largest cash deal in corporate history. The anti-corporatist activist, who in the role of a revivalist minister leads the Church of Stop Shopping, joins us to discuss the Thanksgiving dinner he hosted in front of Monsanto's world headquarters in St. Louis, protesting the killing of honeybees by Bayer and Monsanto, who have joined forces today in what the Reverend Billy sees as a deal with the devil. And joining us now is Alan Abramowitz, who's a professor of political science at Emory University and the author of Voice of the People, Elections and Voting Behavior in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Abramowitz.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be with you.
And what do you make of the premise that I sort of put forth in the opening there, that Donald Trump is a salesman and he's selling a product, which is himself, and he's caught the somewhat staid and sclerotic political world by storm. And if there are enough people in this country who have sort of become consumers as opposed to citizens, will he make it?
Well, I think there's no question that salesmanship is an important part of political campaigning. so that's not really new to Donald Trump. But Trump is a different kind of salesman than we're used to in the political realm. He's someone who comes from a background in real estate and in reality TV. And so in that field, I think that the key to successful salesmanship is often, especially in reality TV, of course, is shocking the audience and thereby attracting people's interest. So we've seen Trump use this approach very successfully in the Republican primaries this year, much to the astonishment, I think, of the Republican establishment, where he was successful in knocking off a large field of much more experienced Republican politicians and ending up, you know, with the Republican nomination. The question now is whether this approach, this particular type of salesmanship, can be as successful in a general election campaign where you're dealing with a much larger and more diverse target audience.
Well, it does seem that the reality TV star is running a kind of survivor in the White House campaign. The more outrageous, the more insulting, the more bullying, the more he can force other people off the island, which he did with all of the Republicans candidates that you just mentioned, then he's the last man standing. That is the nature of these phony reality shows. And it seems like But do you think the connection with the press is key here? Because I yesterday spoke with James Fellows, who felt that if Donald Trump became president, you might well be able to blame the press for it, in as much as he's gotten all this free advertising. And
right.
he just constantly calls up the press, and they put him on, whether it's Fox, whether it's CNN, whether it's MSNBC. He dominates the airwaves, whereas I get the impression that Hillary Clinton is kind of leery of the press and therefore is suffering.
Well, Trump is leery of the press in his own way. He has been careful to kind of restrict press access to himself. He has actually removed press credentials of certain reporters and news outlets that he feels are unfavorable toward him. So he also has a somewhat difficult relationship with the press. There's no question that he was able to use his ability to gain free media coverage as a tremendous asset in the Republican primary contest. He did not have to spend very much money. He was greatly outspent, in fact, by several other candidates. And yet he was able to defeat them because he could get almost as much free media coverage as he wanted, because the media know that putting him on the air would attract an audience. And that's, of course, what they were trying to do. However, the problem is that not all publicity is good publicity. So this old adage that, you know, any coverage is good doesn't turn out to actually be accurate when it comes to politics, because we know that Trump ended up with the highest negatives of any presidential candidate in American political, or at least in modern American political history, as far back as we have data. And so he's carrying a lot of negative baggage that he picked up along the way, some before the campaign and much of it during the campaign. He's insulted and turned off a great many voters as well. So I myself am quite skeptical that this approach is going to end up being successful in a general election campaign where you have a much larger percentage of the public who are skeptical about his message. In the Republican primaries, he was sort of targeting a segment of the Republican electorate, a large segment of the Republican electorate that found his particular message very negative, hyperbolic, message attacking outgroups, attacking Mexicans, attacking Muslims, you know, attacking immigrants, that actually found that message quite appealing. Now that we're turning to the general election, or we're well into the general election campaign, however, we see that there are large groups of voters who are very turned off by that message. And he's antagonized some large and growing groups of voters, particularly Latinos and other minorities in this country. So his salesmanship has not worked very well with those groups.
And again, I'm speaking with Alan Abramowitz, who is a professor of political science at Emory University and the author of Voice of the People, Elections and Voting Behavior in the United States. But how then does that explain that Donald Trump is level with Hillary Clinton in some polls? And she had an enormous bounce following the Democratic convention, which many pundits have suggested was one of the most successful in recent history. And now she's obviously on a downward trajectory and he's on an upward trajectory. So to my mind, she should be 20 or 30 points ahead, given what a reckless amateur and a liar and an insulter and all of the things that we've become familiar
right.
with. And yet she's floundering.
Well, here's the thing. I think, first of all, that Hillary Clinton still has a lead. Nationally and in most of the swing states. And I think we have to be careful about interpreting the results of these polls. We're going to see variability and fluctuations in the poll results as we go through the campaign, just as we did in 2012. Well, and for a good deal of the time, it appeared that Mitt Romney was even ahead of Barack Obama. And in the end, it turned out that Obama had the advantage. So I think Hillary Clinton still has the advantage. But you're not going to see a landslide election. That just doesn't happen anymore in American politics, because the country and the electorate are much too polarized for that to happen. And so there's a very large segment of the electorate, the vast majority of Republican voters in this country, who simply will not consider voting for a Democrat, particularly Hillary Clinton. They view Hillary Clinton as a terrible person, and an evil person, actually, if you look at the polling. Clinton supporters and Democrats generally, of course, have an equally negative view of Donald Trump. So we have a country that's really a very divided, pretty closely divided between, you know, supporters of the two major parties. That's why our elections in recent years have tended to be very close. We haven't had a landslide presidential election since 1984. And I think this election is going to end up being a close election. It's going to be decided by a few percentage points and then popular vote. But again, I still think Clinton has the advantage and will end up winning by a small but still significant margin in the popular vote and by a fairly large margin in the electoral vote.
But given the narrow nature of the race that you've just outlined, Alan Abramowitz, what do you think of the role then of particularly the Libertarian candidate who's doing quite well? My understanding is that from Hillary Clinton's own internal polling, they're quite concerned that many voters for Bernie Sanders are migrating to vote for Gary Johnson.
What I'm seeing in the polling is that it's not so much Sanders voters who are voting for Johnson. He's pulling votes from some disgruntled Democrats and some Sanders supporters. The vast majority of Sanders supporters are supporting Hillary Clinton. I was just looking at the Washington Post a poll that came out a few days ago that gives a pretty detailed breakdown on that. Johnson is drawing support from some disgruntled Republicans who don't care for Trump, from some disgruntled Democrats who don't care for Hillary Clinton. Jill Stein is drawing support. She's not getting very much, but the support she is getting is coming very disproportionately from disgruntled Democrats, from some former Sanders supporters. So that's where some of the Sanders vote is going as well. The question is, as we get closer to the election, what will happen to these voters who are right now thinking about voting for one of these third-party candidates, and will they stick with that decision? We know from the polling data and from past elections that third-party supporters are much less stable, that they are much less committed to their candidate than the supporters of the two major parties. So my suspicion is what we'll see is that Gary Johnson's support will trail off, that we'll see at least some decline in his support. I still expect to end up seeing him, to see him ending up with 5 or 6% of the vote, substantially more than he got in 2012 and more than any previous Libertarian candidate. So I do expect that to happen. But in the end, I doubt that that his voters will determine the outcome of the election.
But then just to, in the last few minutes, to turning back to the press and the facility with which Donald Trump uses the press and the sort of tacit smoldering hostility, if you will, between the press and Hillary Clinton. I mean, it's amazing to watch the way they piled on about her ill-advised statement about Trump's basket of horrible of deplorables. At the same time, Trump is out on the campaign saying that if the Iranians get too close to one of our beautiful warships and make rude gestures at our sailors, he'll blow them out of the water, an act of war. No, virtually no coverage. Today we've had this absurdity that we're, you know, first of all, we had the absurdity of his doctor, his gastroenterologist, this sort of old hippie with a sort of his strange wife behind him in the 5-minute almost illiterate letter that he wrote. That was absurd enough, but now he's on Dr. Oz, supposedly going to tell all about his medical condition. Of course, it was completely staged. And it leads me to the point that in this internet age, it's the headline that grabs the attention, not the retraction that comes later. And that's what seems to be Trump's tactic. He lies brazenly or puts on a completely fatuous show like with Dr. Oz. And that takes a few days for people to realize that the whole thing was a fraud, if they ever realize it at all.
Well, I think the press have a responsibility here to point out the truth. And they haven't done a very good job, frankly, in dealing with that. They don't know how to deal with a candidate like Donald Trump, but they've never really had to deal with a candidate who has, you know, lied that brazenly. Now, it is true, however, that we're beginning to see, I think, some more attention given to some of his lies and to questions about his health, to questions about his tax returns. And, you know, I think it's going to be very interesting to see how the press handle the debates and how the moderators handle the debates. We saw a great deal of criticism of Matt Lauer after that fiasco of an interview with, two interviews with Clinton and then with Trump, in which he obviously gave her a much harder time than Trump and failed to follow up and question Trump on his claim, which has been thoroughly debunked, that he opposed the Iraq War from the beginning. So I think the moderators have now been put on notice, you know, that the public expects them to call out candidates who lie. Hopefully we'll see more attention to that. I don't think Trump's going to do very well in the debates. I think the kind of bluster and name-calling that he used to great advantage in the primaries and in some of those debates, I think, is not going to play very well in the general election campaign. You know, the silly season is over, and we're getting down here to the end of the general election campaign. I think there'll be an attempt to force the candidates to talk more about substance, to flesh out some of the policies that they're proposing. And clearly, Hillary Clinton is much better prepared to do that than Donald Trump. And hopefully, you know, we will see that in a 90-minute debate on September 26th.
But again, that your prediction is premised on the notion that there's a kind of sufficient number of educated, rational people in the country. We live in a country where the truth is a moving target, that people do reality shopping. Liberals get their information from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox. There's no consensus about what is true. That's the scary part from my mind, is I don't really know the real breakdown of in this country of whether there are enough rational, educated people to get the reasonable candidate over the top, as opposed to those consumers beguiled by Trump's salesmanship.
Well, I expect the large majority of those watching, and it will be a very large audience, will respond, along party lines. They'll respond in line with their predispositions. So obviously those who are already committed to Donald Trump are going to see what they want to see. Clinton supporters are going to see what they want to see. However, I do think there is an opportunity in the debates to have voters exposed to at least some of reality, and to show them how prepared are these candidates to actually discuss serious issues and problems that are facing this country. And I think there are enough voters out there, I think, who are capable of recognizing the difference, because it's a very stark difference in this case between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. In Donald Trump, you've got the least prepared, least experienced, in many ways most ignorant candidate who's ever run for president of the United States as a major party nominee. I'm fairly optimistic that will be exposed. I don't expect the debates to move the needle very much, one way or the other. But I think they will kind of reinforce the divisions that already exist in the country. And I think in the end, that will help Hillary Clinton to eke out at least a modest victory in this election.
Well, Alan Abramowitz, I thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. Glad to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alan Abramowitz, who's a professor of political science at Emory University and the author of Voice of the People, Elections and Voting Behavior in the United States. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the $38 billion 10-year arms deal with Israel announced today. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kate Gould, who's a legislative representative for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies for Israeli-Palestinian peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kate Gould.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
Well, thank you for joining us, Kate. And today, the president announced this aid package to Israel that quoting Obama, will make a significant contribution to Israel's security in what remains a dangerous neighborhood. And he went on to say the continued supply of the world's most advanced weapons technology will assure that Israel has the ability to defend itself from all manner of threats. Now, for the longest time, Israel has been the biggest recipient of U.S. aid of any other country in the world. And now it's gone up from, I think, $3.2 billion a year to $3.8 billion a year. But at the same time, Israel has an extremely robust and wealthy economy. So is that, in terms of your lobby on Capitol Hill, does that ever come up, that why the American taxpayer being so generous to a country that's doing so well?
Well, unfortunately, there is very little appetite on Capitol Hill for providing accountability through reining in U.S. military aid to Israel. Many members of Congress have, you know, heralded this aids package, even though it is, yeah, the largest aid package that the U.S. has ever provided to any country. And I think that what we've seen is that a number of kind of progressive Democrats, those who brand themselves that way, have come out with statements supporting the aid package, applauding it with great enthusiasm. And then the dissent that you've seen is unfortunately the dissent that this isn't enough, that this should be a ceiling that this should be a floor rather than a ceiling. And in fact, I do think, I mean, that this will ultimately be a floor rather than a ceiling, that Congress will add more money in the end, as they've done over the years. So as you said, it's there's been already this aid package of over $3.1 billion per year. But even beyond that, Congress has continually added money through the appropriations process to fund Israel's various defense systems. And so now I think we're going to see more of that, even though we're seeing even more aid, $3.8 billion a year over 10 years, that Israel's going to continue to pile that on. I mean, there was a piece of this, a concession that Netanyahu made with this, that he wasn't allowed to, the Israeli government wouldn't be allowed to ask for more money from Congress unless there would be another war. But even in the absence of a specific request from Prime Minister Netanyahu to Congress, I think there are those in Congress who are already waiting to just pile on more money.
But is there any discussion in Congress about the extent to which the U.S. subsidizes Israel's very, very successful arms industry, and that U.S. taxpayer-generated research, which ends up in weapons programs and designs and systems, end up in Israel, and then they get then sold on to countries like China. China's entire tank force was upgraded with Israeli technology to make their old tanks have, you know, better siding for their guns, etc. And the same thing happens with their aircraft, with avionics. For example, Putin's surrogates in Ukraine and in Crimea are using Israeli drones to in the battlefield against the Ukrainians, etc. So,
right.
Does any of this ever sort of resonate with lawmakers who, you know, you would think would want some guarantees that at least Israel, as America's ally, shouldn't be arming America's enemies?
Right. Right. Well, we certainly, I have been in talking with congressional offices. I've heard from some members of Congress behind closed doors. I mean, they wouldn't want to talk about this publicly, but that they are concerned about the manner in which Israel uses this military aid. And I think that is one of the reasons why there is this change this time in this aid package that that Prime Minister Netanyahu, one of the concessions was he agreed to phase out the special agreement that's existed for decades that has allowed Israel to spend 26% of its aid package on Israeli defense research, development, and procurement that I think allows for a lot more loopholes about how that money is spent, and you know, with research and development, then you can cooperate with various countries, and you can see these sorts of how that would lead to some of this research and development being used by other countries. So, so now in this new aid package that Israel would not have that, that they would actually have to spend all this money on American companies providing the goods and services. So, and I should say, I mean, that arrangement that was worked out in the past, you know, over these decades, no other country receiving U.S. funding was allowed to have that kind of latitude with U.S. military aid. So now, at least in that respect, that now it's a bit different in that it's Israel's under the same rules, just in that one regard, as other recipients, as other countries that receive U.S. military aid. I think to your broader point, I mean, there certainly is some concern from members of Congress about, I would say a very small number, but they're there, about the lack of accountability and oversight over this over the military aid. But I think it's very much taken for granted that it's not going to change unless there's actually more military aid added. That said, I will say, you know, there are various signs of members of Congress speaking out about Israeli policies, about Israeli occupation policies in new ways, including, for example, there was a letter earlier this year from Senator Leahy and 10 members of Congress, 10 representatives, who sent a letter to the president with concerns about the Leahy law being violated, about U.S. military aid going to Israel and Egypt that could have been used in various human rights violations, and they wanted to see some investigations to see whether the military aid was used for to perpetrate these gross violations of human rights. So there's a little bit of that around the edges now. I mean, but I do want to be clear that those are separate issues, and that even if there was some accountability on that front, that wouldn't actually affect the overall number of, you know, the overall aid package to Israel. But I mentioned that in terms of the context of just what the discourse on this general matter of U.S. military aid to Israel looks like on Capitol Hill.
And again, I'm speaking with Kate Gould, who's the legislative representative for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and she lobbies for Israeli-Palestinian peace. And of course, I don't see how this arms deal is going to move that peace process forward, which has been stalled forever. It is a process. It's not about peace. It's about process. It's been a massive fraud for the decades now. I just wonder whether or not we should kid ourselves that there's such a thing as a peace process. I don't mean to make your work seem futile, but that's the way I see it.
Well, I think, so first I would say we are FCNL, we're a Quaker lobby in the public interest, as you say. I mean, we are very much opposed to this military aid package, and it's very disheartening to see that in the midst of so many gross violations of human rights that the U.S. is in fact sending this message that they're going to continue perpetuating this occupation, now entering, you know, now in its 50th year, coming close to the 50th anniversary in 2017. So I think that is certainly a cause for alarm, and we should all, and if we don't want to see even more U.S. taxpayer dollars going into funding the occupation, then we need to talk to our members of Congress so that they don't add more money. So I think that that's important to note. I would also note that, so this is certainly a $38 billion, you know, for 10 years, that is the largest aid package in history. It's absolutely absurd in every way. That said, there was a lot of pressure on the Obama administration to actually raise it to 45 or even $50 billion. I think last time I was on your show, we were talking about reports of Prime Minister Netanyahu was really pushing for that 45 or $50 billion over 10 years. And there is a lot of discontent among those who've supported a lot of the status quo policies in Israel, who've supported this endless occupation, and they've been saying that's not enough money, and that's why there's so much ire among some in Congress saying we need to give a lot more. It's $38 billion. That is less than 45. But I think it, you know, to your broader point about what kind of peace process there is now, I think what we're seeing is more and more that the international community, that and even some in Congress are really focusing on these basic human rights issues that we can really have an impact on in the immediate term, that are going to be essential for any kind of genuine peace process. As you say, I mean, the peace process of the past has really lost so much of its legitimacy, and in order to actually have a real peace process, and in fact, it's hard to even use those terms, but real negotiations and a real chance for an end to the occupation and a just and inclusive negotiations process that leads to peace for Israelis and Palestinians. In order to get to that point, then we do have to act immediately to address, you know, these grave human rights abuses happening. I mean, and one I would just mention is, for example, in the West Bank right now, I was actually just on the phone with people who were, in Sousia, there's a village in the West Bank, in Area C of the West Bank, and they are facing the threat of demolition. This is an issue where, unlike so many of these issues that have to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that Israel has not said that this is a security issue for them. This is actually, they have not used that excuse. This is simply a matter of this village, like so many Palestinian villages, being at the threat of extinction because the Israeli army wants to demolish it to make room for more settlements. There are members of Congress speaking out about this. There are actually, there have been many, many visits from European delegations, from members of the State Department, from other U.S. officials, U.N. officials, who have said to Israel, look, you can't continue to do this. It's a village that's become an international symbol for a wider issue, which is that we really have to all speak out against this further expansion of the occupation so that we can see a really prospects for a better, brighter future for Israelis and Palestinians.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Kate Gould, let's talk about the de facto alliance that exists between Israel, that received the $38 billion gift of the latest U.S. arms, and Egypt, which is also a part of the Camp David deal. They get a subsidy, less than Israel, but that's been going on since the deal was made with Jimmy Carter and Arafat and Begin. Sadat and Begin. But Egypt now is a military dictatorship under General Sisi, and they have an arrangement with Israel, as does Saudi Arabia, covertly. So you have this strange situation where you have a de facto alliance between Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, all of whom are receiving arms from the United States.
That's right. But I would say we have an opportunity to actually influence that and to lay the groundwork for a new kind of U.S. relationship with the Middle East. And I would flag that on Tuesday, the Senate is going to be voting on whether to allow this latest arms deal, this $1.15 billion, billion with a B, dollar arms deal to Saudi Arabia to go through. And Senators Murphy and Rand Paul, they have a bill to block this deal from going forward. We now have five total sponsors on it from both parties, and we're hoping to get a lot more groups who want to, or individuals who want to get involved. You can call your senator at 1-855-68-NO-WAR and make that call to your senator's office. I know most folks listening to this will be in California, so I would say Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer are not on the bill yet. We would love to have them on board. Senator Feinstein, of course, is on the ranking member of the Intel Committee, and Senator Boxer's on Foreign Relations Committee. So they're both very important voices on this vote. They are going to be asked, yes or no, you know, do you want to send a signal to Saudi Arabia that we're going to reward them with more bombs as they are bombing hospitals, schools, and markets in Yemen? And as you say, I mean, these issues are all related. This is really about whether the U.S. is going to relate to the Middle East by simply dropping more bombs it's an attempt to solve these problems, or whether we're going to actually look at engaging with the people of the region and looking at diplomatic solutions that can work. So that's really at stake. I mean, whether we're going to have our U.S. Middle East policy outsourced to weapons contractors and see this just unending bloodshed, or whether we're going to actually support diplomatic solutions that save lives. So we can change, you know, we can act on that right now by trying to get Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer to co-sponsor SJ Res 39, the Murphy-Paul bill to block the arms deal with Saudi Arabia.
Well, Kate Gould, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Kate Gould, who's the legislative representative for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C., where she lobbies for Israeli-Palestinian peace. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with the Reverend Billy about the Bayer, the German pharmaceutical and chemical giant, buying the pesticide giant Monsanto. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is the Reverend Billy, who is an anti-corporatist activist who, in the role of a revivalist minister, leads the Church of Stop Shopping, a group of activists who defend neighborhood economies and freedom of expression in public places. They are known for their vocal exorcisms of cash registers inside super malls and chain stores, and hosted a Thanksgiving dinner in front of Monsanto's world headquarters in St. Louis, where they campaigned against the killing of honeybees by Bayer and Monsanto, two giant pesticide companies who have announced their merger today. Welcome to Background Briefing, the Reverend Billy.
Thank you, Brother Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Your Grace, Your Holiness, Your Eminence. And I thank you on behalf of the honeybees.
Well, that's a struggle that I'm afraid the buzzing jury is still out. We have continued bad news about the ability of this marvelous being, this flying, this genius insect that has been a partner to human beings since. Some people say that we partnered for the honey, that we partnered with honeybees long, long ago, that they have been partners to people since before we partnered with a horse or a dog, and they're in trouble.
Well, therefore, I take it that the merger with Bayer that make the pesticide that kills honeybees and Monsanto is bad news, right?
Oh, this is like the marriage of two devils, I'm afraid. Bayer, its crop science division was invented by a man who, the CEO of Bayer at in the 50s, was there at Auschwitz and with other leaders of the chemical industry in Nazi Germany, had a hand in that atrocity. Bayer goes directly back in its lineage to Nazi Germany and the concentration camps. And we feel that they haven't really changed very much. We don't really, their approach to the natural world, their approach to people, is, you know, take that latest laboratory invention and put it into the water, put it into the air, and just see what happens. And like Monsanto, they work the press, they work the regulatory agencies. They're just a prime example of an abusive corporation.
Well, this German pharmaceutical and chemical giant, Bayer, that you are describing, the Reverend Billy, certainly have a lot of cash on hand. They're paying $66 million in this all-cash takeover of
Monsanto. That's billion. Billion dollars. Not so, million. Billion dollars.
I know. I'm clearly...
Clearly, more money than you can even imagine.
Right, I meant
Ian.
To say billion. I'm sorry, yeah. Grace. These numbers are just too much for me. My humble pocketbook, being as it is an astronomical figure.
It is a lot of money.
And clearly money talks in this world, unfortunately. But I remember talking to a scientist about how these neonicotinoids are killing the bees, and it was he gave a very clear picture of how this chemical that's put on the Roundup seeds to prevent, you know, that kills all the weeds except the seeds that they don't want killed, and that what happens is to the crops is that the neonicotinoids, the plant sort of sweats, and the neonicotinoids seep on the leaves and stems of the plant. And in the morning, the honeybees come along and kind of sort of bathe themselves in that sweat, if you will, and that's what's killing them. Is that the picture that you're familiar with?
I would put it a little bit differently. Monsanto is famous for lots of toxins that have come into our lives, Agent Orange, PCBs, DDT, but... The one that right now is prominent are the glyphosates. Glyphosates have been found to be probably carcinogenic by the World Health Organization. The United Nations has been banned by scores of countries. Is now under review finally by the EPA, which is famously corrupted by Monsanto. Glyphosate is the central toxin in the world's most famous and popular herbicide, Roundup, an old cowboy term. So Monsanto's Roundup is sprayed in parks and schools, on highway medians. It's just saturating the United States. And my group, the Church of Stop Shopping, is creating maps where we file Freedom of Information Act requests of different jurisdictions and legally force them to tell us where their toxins are sprayed, where the glyphosates are sprayed. And they are legally obligated to cough up the information. And now we have, at revbilly.com, we have 10 cities filed there, maps. You can just go down in and see how close you are to a spraying event of glyphosates. Glyphosates are the principal partner to genetically engineered commercial crops, soybeans and corn and so forth. So the crop duster goes in there and sprays with this broad-spectrum herbicide and kills everything except the cash crop. And that's why glyphosates are bad for bees, because all the flowers and the weeds along the edges of a traditional farm, they're killed. Now, neonicotinoids are... I thought in your description that you mixed up glyphosate and neonicotinoids, but a lot of your description really did apply to neonicotinoids. Neonicotinoids is Bayer's main famous poison. Although Bayer, like Monsanto, has had generations of suspect substances coming into our lives. Right now, the neonicotinoids are killing the bees. The bees come to the flowers. They take the neonicotinoids into their systems, and the neonicotinoids destroy their sophisticated navigation systems. They might be 3 or 4 miles away from their hive, and they can't find their way home. It's very poignant. They go off in the wrong direction and eventually just die. So last year we suffered a 40% reduction in the population of the honeybees, and we're sort of waiting for this summer's reports. Last summer there was a severe downturn in their population. The creators of the neonicotinoids and the creators of the glyphosate would be coming together and merging is some kind of Orwellian nightmare. If George Orwell predicted that there would be one source of culture, one source of economy, one source of everything, religion, government, if it would come from one big brother, this is a giant step in that direction.
And again, I'm speaking with the Reverend Billy, who's an anti-corporatist activist who, in the role of a revivalist minister, leads the Church of Stop Shopping, a group of activists who defend neighborhood economies and freedom of expression in public places. They are known for their vocal exorcisms of cash registers inside super malls and chain stores, and hosted a Thanksgiving dinner in front of Monsanto's world headquarters in St. Louis, where they campaigned against the killing of honeybees by Bayer and Monsanto, two giant pesticide companies who have announced their merger today. And again, it's a $66 billion all-cash deal that Bayer has offered to acquire Monsanto with, and this would consolidate their hold over the $100 billion global market. It's, of course, going to be subject to some review from the Senate Judicial Committee, etc. They're beginning hearings on Tuesday. What's your sense, Reverend, about whether the United States government is going to do the people's business or the corporation's business?
Well, Monsanto is very popular, in particular, on Capitol Hill and in the White House. Obama and the Clintons are very much neoliberal allies of Hugh Grant, not the actor. Hugh Grant, who is the CEO of Monsanto, is becoming a very wealthy person if this thing goes through. I would predict that in this lame duck last minute, the kind of stuff that happens at the end of an eight-year presidential double term, I would predict that he'll sneak it through with his effort to pass the TPP free trade agreement. Bayer is a German company. It doesn't have, multiple people in the federal agencies like Monsanto does. Monsanto's like Goldman Sachs. They expect executives to go through the revolving door. The head of the FDA for much of Obama's second term was Michael Taylor, who is a top lawyer for Monsanto. So you have a very powerful company in Washington in the Obama administration.
And Senator Chuck Grassley, the Republican chair of the Judiciary Committee, is he going to listen to the Iowa farmers or is he going to bend over for corporate power?
Iowa is the most glyphosate-drenched state in the union. I'm going there in about a month to help the protests and preach. And Monsanto is the devil. We'll be ringing up and down the streets of Des Moines as the Monsanto, and I'm sure Bayer people will be there as well. Everybody will be talking about the merger. They have a kind of Oscar ceremony for GMO pesticide herbicide people, and they award cash prizes totaling hundreds of thousands of dollars to people who are in academia, people who are in laboratories, people who sell their line of goods, which is basically industrial agriculture. It's what they think is the future. It's what they piously say will feed the world. So Iowa is the center of that kind of agriculture. But I've heard that increasing numbers of people, even in Iowa, are switching to organic farming. So they are not without, thank God, not without their opponents. And the people need to stand up to these companies right now at this particular point in time, because climate change, the earth, extinction waves, the unsettled quality of our culture, the mass murders. We have a time when there's much pain and suffering, but it's also a time of change. And right now is not the time to let these gigantic corporations consolidate their power over our lives.
And this,
how's that for some preaching, Brother Ian?
I'm feeling the rapture. So, Reverend, though, tell me, though, you know, this, of course, again, is the largest cash transaction in corporate history. It's a huge deal in that world. But one of the problems is that with global warming, for example, now they're talking about mitigation as opposed to trying to stop the destruction of the planet, but to somehow mitigate and deal with the consequences. And I understand that one of the solutions, in quotes, for the killing off of the bees is to have robo-bees. And I take it that you recently protested the lab where the robo-bee is being developed.
Yes, the laboratory is called the Microbiology, the Microrobotics Laboratory, in Harvard University, financed mysteriously, but we think it's financed by DARPA, the person who is the top professor there, is a man named Robert Wood, and Professor Wood was a DARPA fellow, so he comes right out of the Pentagon's drone program. But for many years, dating all the way back to the 50s, the science fiction idea from the Pentagon that nature can be weaponized, that geese and hummingbirds and toads and eagles flying above us and bacteria coming into our bodies can be made into weapons so that the natural world can explode and kill you when someone in some distant place hits their remote, the way that conventional drones are exploded thousands of miles from the often, you know, often the wrong target, often civilian victims. Our friend Nadia Benjamin has done such wonderful work opposing the drone weapons.
Right.
Well, they're doing that with the honeybees.
So, but this is obviously nanotech bees. That, I mean, we know about the weaponization of dolphins by the U.S. Navy, but my understanding is that the idea is to make these, through nanotech, make these robo bees to replace the bees that have been killed off by the pesticides, so that plants like almonds and all the fruit crops and agriculture that depends upon the bee pollinating the plant will be done by little robots. And I mean, it's an insane idea.
That's what they, if you go to the RoboBee Laboratory website, I think it's robobee.com, I believe you can find the number one purpose that they are stating is their motive for the whole program, and they present it as a humanitarian gesture to us, is mechanical pollination. Mechanical pollination. Well, of course, the genius of the hive and the precision navigation and the waggle dance, the perfumed percussive dance by the stout bees, the performances. It seems like every few months we're getting another amazing piece of research about the intelligence, the language that exists in the honeybee's hive. You can't replicate that. You can't make that mechanical.
But you can.
And in fact, they have not been able to do it yet. They have not been able to. And the laboratory's been open, I think, 8 or 9 years now, spending a lot of Pentagon money. Monsanto claims it's not their money. Bayer claims has nothing to do with it.
Right, but
they must be waiting for the mechanical pollination to succeed because they're killing the pollinators.
Right.
So far, they've not been able to do it.
Right, but that would be the ultimate cruel irony, wouldn't it be, that the people who kill off the bees then start selling these goddamn robo-bees to the farmers, you know, to make more money. I mean, it's the ultimate in sort of demonic capitalism.
Yes, they want the farmers to sit at a computer or a bank of computers inside some sort of floating office above the farm and to be utterly out of touch with the mysterious upwelling magic of an ecosystem.
Right.
Whereas in the old days, a farmer, and in the present day, in organic farming, the farmer is in a duet with the natural world, and the farmer respects that the creation in a cubic inch of soil has more mystery than he'll ever or she will ever know.
Well,
farmers respect and they find a way to pray to it, regardless of their religion. They have a real farmer is a spiritual worker.
Well, Reverend Billy, I thank you for your experience and wisdom on this matter. It is a dark day for nature and for the honeybee, but keep up the good fight, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Brother Ian. Earthalleluia, everybody.
Earthalleluia to you. And again, I've been speaking with Reverend Billy, who's an anti-corporatist activist, who in the role of a revivalist minister leads the Church of Stop Shopping, a group of activists who defend neighborhood economies and freedom of expression in public places. They are known for their vocal exorcisms of cash registers inside super malls and chain stores, and hosted a Thanksgiving dinner in front of Monsanto's world headquarters in St. Louis, where they campaigned against the killing of honeybees by Bayer and Monsanto, two giant pesticide companies who have announced their merger today. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Disappeared by 9:30.